address that's not only out of their office's jurisdiction, but also out of their hunting ground. Stafford. 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 Listen to your gut, Mercedes. It's telling you something. Run that address against my old cases. Let's see. In the silence of the house, I can hear the click of keys over the phone. Holy shit, Mercedes. 9 years ago, a 14-year-old girl named Kara Irritt, her father beat her, raped her, and prostituted her to his friends. Fuck, you stayed with her in the hospital. A guardian angel, I murmur, remembering. She said she finally had a guardian angel. Her mother drove her car into a tree when Kara was 9 or 10. Her father's still in prison, the rest of his life, I seem to recall. So he's not still living at that house. And I doubt Kara is either. We looked at her case this morning, but couldn't trace her after high school. Where is she now? We'll dig in and find out. I'll call back when we've got it. Kara Irritt, Sterling repeats, tasting the name. She was on our short list, but what's her connection to Gloria? Or to whoever's using Gloria's login? I shake my head, the final threads still just out of reach. She was blonde as a kid, but her father dyed her hair red when he started renting her to his friends, I tell her. The details I read so recently crowding in on me. What if we're looking for Kara, but she... My phone rings again before I can finish the thought, but it isn't Cass. It's an unfamiliar number. Ramirez? Mercedes, comes a hoarse whisper. Mercedes, she's here. She's here? Where's here? Who is this? It's Amelia, the girl on the other end of the call whispers. The lady who killed my parents. She's here at my Uncle Lincoln's. 26. We're on our way, I promise immediately, and Sterling has her keys and phones in hand before we even get to the door. She tosses me her keys so she can get the phones ready. Amelia, are you safe? Are you hiding?
No, I have to warn my uncle.
Amelia, you need to hide. My hands are steady as I jam the keys in the ignition, training beating adrenaline. I can see Sterling texting Cass with one phone and looking up the number for the Chantilly police with the other.
I can't let him die like my mom did. He's been taking real good care of me. He's nice, and he doesn't hurt me. I can't just leave him.
Is she in the house? I ask, pulling out of the driveway. Sterling grabs the phone from my shoulder and switches it to speaker, sliding it into a cradle sticking out of the cigarette lighter.
No, she's just walking around it.
Is it just you and your uncle in the house?
No, his girlfriend's here.
Okay. Amelia, run to their room if you can do it without being seen through a window. Wake them up. But be sneaky. If they're loud, you could all get hurt. Keep the phone with you. I can hear her heavy breathing over the line. Mother of God, this girl is brave. Sterling cups her hand around her mouth and the mic on her phone to muffle her conversation with the dispatch officer in Chantilly. Driving like a bat out of hell, I tap the other phone and make a swirling motion with my finger, the closest I can get to lights. She gets it, though, and starts punching in another text, this one to Holmes, to let her know we're driving like LEOs in a personal vehicle without lights or sirens. She tells the dispatch officer, too, so hopefully we'll be able to get to Chantilly without a well-meaning officer pulling us over for violating a dozen or two traffic laws. Lincoln Anders' groggy voice comes through the background.
Amelia? What is it, Emmy?
The lady who killed my parents. She's outside, she tells him, and the phone is right up against her face.
Did you have a nightmare, sweetheart?
Asks a female voice, just as sleep-muddled.
God, it's later than I thought.
No, she's here. She's just outside. We have to hide.
Amelia, put the phone on speaker, I tell her. Let your uncle hear me.
Okay,
she pants, and I can hear the change in the background. Mr. Anders, this is FBI agent Mercedes Ramirez. Amelia called me. If she says the woman is outside, believe her. The Chantilly police are on their way to your address. Is there a cellar or basement where you can hide?
No,
he answers, suddenly sounding much more awake.
There's a root cellar.
I cringe.
But the entrance is outside. You can't get there from here.
Do you have any weapons in the house?
No.
The address is outside city limits, Sterling whispers. Dispatch says two cars will be there in 10.
10 minutes? Jesus fucking Christ.
Can you get out of the house? I demand. Can you get to a neighbor?
Come on, Stasia, get up. We'll just...
He cuts himself off, and Amelia whimpers.
She's in the house,
he hisses. Get out. Get out now. Sterling holds her phone near the microphone, the recording function lit up, and gives me a wide-eyed look. A gunshot cracks through the silence, followed by a grunt and two screams.
Amelia, run!
I yell through the gunshots that follow. Amelia's the only one screaming now. I don't even know if she heard me.
Stop! A muffled voice commands on the other end. Stop! You're safe now!
Amelia is sobbing now, and then there's a startled grunt.
Stop fighting me! The voice snaps. You're safe now! You're going to be okay!
Amelia!
More grunts, and Amelia's screaming again, feral, broken things that must be shredding her throat, and then... Another gunshot, and a heavy thump.
No, no, no,
whines the voice.
No, it wasn't supposed to happen like this. No, no, you're supposed to be safe. I'm making you safe,
she screams, and it tangles off into a choking rasp. I can barely hear footsteps. The time between treads says she's running. And shit, the police aren't there yet. They can't get there in time to stop her.
Kara!
I yell, wondering if she can hear me.
Kara! It's Mercedes! Do you remember me?
But the only thing I can hear is the pained groans of someone still alive. Tears running down bloodless cheeks, Sterling tells the dispatch officer to send ambulances. Too many minutes later, we hear the officers arrive, calling into the house.
This one's alive,
one shouts, and someone steps on Amelia's phone before they can say who it is. I'm doing 110 in a 45, and I wasn't anywhere near fast enough. When we screech to a halt in front of the Anders house, lights are flashing everywhere, pressing in on wounds that are far more raw than usual. Two ambulances are in the drive, and as we run up to the front door, two paramedics rush out with a gurney. There's a man on it, her dad's cousin, Lincoln Anders.
The little girl, I snap.
One of them shakes his head, and they push past into the ambulance. There's an officer at the door, and he barely gives our credentials a glance. The woman and the girl were dead before they hit the ground, he tells us. Woman was shot through the heart. The girl took one to the head, point blank.
We were on the phone with her,
Sterling tells him, voice shaking. She saw the intruder, called us, and went to wake up her uncle and his girlfriend. They were trying to leave the house.
Why did she call you? Why not the police?
Her parents were murdered on the 3rd. I scrub my hands against my cheeks. She was delivered to my house, and I gave her my number if she needed anything. She saw the same woman outside here.
You're that one?
Sterling, honest to God, growls at him, and he flushes.
I didn't mean anything by it, he says quickly. Dispatch said the call came from the FBI, and we didn't know why, that's all. We saw the story in the paper.
Agent Kathleen Watts is the lead agent on the case, and she's partnered with Detectives Holmes and Mignone, out of Manassas.
Chief got a call from Watts. She should be just behind you.
It'll take her longer from... Sterling stops, watching an SUV with flashing lights slam to a stop behind her. She was still in Manassas. Mercedes, she was still in Manassas.
Which means she was still questioning Gloria.
Watts and Holmes run up the lawn.
Kara Irritt, Watts calls, before they even reach us. She changed her name to Carolyn Tillerman after she left foster care. She's one of the file clerks. We've got officers on their way to her apartment and an APB out on her car.
Carolyn Tillerman. Cass and I spoke face to face with her at the CPS office. I look at Holmes, who's significantly more shaken. We were on the phone with Amelia. She closes her eyes, hand automatically rising so she can kiss her thumbnail. We all looked at Lincoln Anders when he said he'd take Amelia in, Sterling says. CPS did their checks, but so did we. He was completely clean. The closest he'd come to trouble was a couple of speeding tickets. Why in the hell would she attack him?
CPS received an anonymous complaint this morning.
Anonymous.
This morning?
Watts nods impatiently.
Caller said his girlfriend couldn't be trusted with children because she killed a boy.
What? We both demand.
When Stasia Yakova was a teenager, she was helping her father clean his guns at the kitchen table, and a neighbor called over to ask her father's help with something heavy. So he told her to put down the gun she was working on, and he'd be right back. Her brother came in, high off his ass, and thought she was an intruder. He attacked her with a knife, got a few slashes and stabs in, because she didn't want to hurt him. But when he got the knife to her throat, she grabbed one of the guns they hadn't worked on yet and shot him in the thigh.
Bled out?
No. She called an ambulance. They got him to the hospital. But when they gave him anesthesia for surgery,
he was a tweaker.
The father walked in at the end of the struggle. He was the one to pull his son off of her. It was clearly self-defense, so she was never charged with anything.
If this anonymous complaint turns out to be one of her brother's former friends or girlfriends, I shake my head. But Kara probably wasn't in any fit state to research it. She heard Amelia's name and decided then and there. My phone rings, and I swear to fucking God. Sterling yanks it out of my hands. It's Cass, she reports, and accepts the call to speaker.
Kearney, you've got Ramirez, Sterling, Watts, and Holmes.
Amelia? She asks immediately.
No.
Damn. She takes a deep, shuddering breath, both inhalation and exhalation clearly audible over the line. Carolyn Tillerman is not at her apartment. Officers found several masks, white jumpsuits, both bloodied and clean, blonde wigs, both bloodied and clean, a box of white angel teddy bears, everything in her kit except a knife and a gun.
but there are boxes of ammunition. Do we know what she's driving? It's a 2004 dark blue Honda CRV. We found all 8 of the files missing from CPS and have agents and officers on the way to those houses to secure the families. What about the address in Stafford? The house is owned by Navy Lieutenant Commander Deshaun Douglas. He lives there with his wife, Octavia, and their 9-year-old daughter, Nichelle. There are no complaints or suspicions of abuse in the household, either in Stafford County or their previous residences. Call SPD. Get officers out there. What are you thinking? Asks Watts. Kara just point-blank murdered a kid she was trying to save. She is freaking the fuck out, and if she tries to go to her apartment, she'll see the police. Where do you go when there's nowhere else to go?
I go home, Holmes says slowly, to my husband and daughter.
Pretend you're 23 and single.
To my parents, then.
But her mother is dead, and her father is in prison. That leaves the house in Stafford, where her father put her through absolute hell. The house where a man is living with his little girl, and she has checked every day to make sure there are no complaints. There still isn't a complaint, Sterling points out.
Do you think that matters anymore to the woman we heard on the phone?
She shakes her head. Burnside is calling Stafford, Cass reports. He'll give a courtesy call to NCIS after, given that the homeowner is a lieutenant commander. We think we may have identified Kara's initial trigger.
What's that?
A few months ago, her father hired a private investigator to find her. When that was successful, he sent her a letter asking her to come see him. The letter's still in her apartment, so we called the prison.
Did she go?
Yes. This, though, her father got remarried, and his wife is expecting a baby. She's having a little girl in August.
You want to tell me how the hell a man in prison for whoring out his daughter gets conjugal visits?
Watts snarls. He doesn't. But when there's a friendly prison guard to smuggle out a sperm sample, new wife can go to a fertility clinic for implantation. Guard was fired, but it was a done deed. And the father who sold her again and again to his friends gets another little girl. I remember interviewing him after the arrest. He probably tracked her down and told her in person just to torture her. Bastard probably got off on getting to hurt her again.
You're right. That has to be our trigger.
We borrowed Blakey, Cuomo, and Kang's teams, so we'd have enough. Hanoverian signed off on it. Her end game is Stafford. My heart beats a rapid tattoo.
She can't help it.
How are you sure?
What do you do when you're lost in the woods?
I ask softly. Sterling takes a step closer to me, leaning into my side. You run home, I remind her. Everything is on fire and overwhelming, and she's running home. But when she gets there, she's going to remember all the ways she was hurt. She's going to see that little girl, and she's going to see herself.
Kearney, send the address to Edison.
He's still here in the office, Cass says.
He's what?
Sterling and I ask together. There's a shuffle and a beep, and then we hear Edison's tired grumble.
Where are we going?
Fill him in on the way. Just get there, Watts orders. Ramirez, Sterling, go.
The regulations?
Sterling asks hesitantly. Screw them. You're the best chance of taking her down. Just make sure Kearney makes the arrest. Give me your keys. Take mine. I've got the lights. She holds out her hand. Sterling takes the keys from me and drops them in Watts's hand, scooping up the ring for the SUV. Sterling had a reputation at the Denver field office for making seasoned agents cry when she drove.
never caused an accident, never incurred damage, but you spend the entire trip praying. Sounds like just what we need. As she peels rubber, getting us down the street, I brace myself by my legs, much as I envision sailors must do during hurricanes.
Please let us get there, I whisper. Por favor.
27. The Douglas's house is painted with flashing red and blue lights when we squeal in. Edison, standing at the front door with a uniform, checks his watch and shudders.
She got here first. Probably came straight from Chantilly, he tells us. Mother is inside. Father's on his way to the hospital, but the mother refuses to leave until her daughter's safe.
The mother's okay?
Shot in the arm, a through and through on her side. The paramedics have her bandaged up, and they're keeping an eye on her. Kearney's with her. Police are organizing traffic stops and a search back into the woods. FBI is sending more agents to help, and if it becomes a search and rescue, the Marines have offered aid out of Quantico.
Let's go inside. I need to talk to Mrs. Douglas. Mrs. Douglas is in her kitchen, both hands wrapped around a glass of water. She's mostly listening to Cass, standing at her side, but she keeps looking out the bay window of the breakfast nook like she'll see her daughter coming down the street. She just saw her husband shot down and her daughter grabbed. And God, I want to be gentle with her, but we don't have time. Mrs. Douglas, my name is Mercedes Ramirez. I'm an agent with the FBI. Are there any places for the neighborhood kids to play? Anything that's been here for a while? She stares at me.
Sorry?
The woman who took your daughter used to live here, not just in the neighborhood, in this very house. She's not going to get out of Stafford. So is there any place where the kids gather? Something they might think is a secret from their parents?
No, I don't think...
She glances at the papers stuck to the door of the fridge and flinches.
There's a treehouse. Nichelle drew a picture of it. She and the girls next door found it a few weeks ago, said it was falling apart, and I scolded her for going so far back into the woods.
Did they tell you where?
No, just said it was far back.
You said the girls next door? Which side? She points, and I run out of the house to go pound on the door, Edison sticking close behind me. The door is opened by a round-faced man in a bathrobe.
What's going on?
He demands.
Are the Douglases okay?
Sir, are your daughters home?
Yes, but what?
Someone took Nichelle Douglas, I tell him bluntly, and we think the woman may be taking her back to a treehouse your daughters found with Nichelle.
We're not allowed to go there anymore,
pipes up a girl from down the hall. She slips up behind her father and looks at us with wide eyes.
Mrs. Douglas said it was too far.
I'm not going to yell at you for it, mija, I say, crouching down closer to eye level. I just need to know where it is. Can you tell us how to get there? She chews anxiously on her lip.
Is Nichelle okay?
We're trying to find her, but we need your help.
Wait.
She races up the stairs and back down again only a moment later with a piece of paper in her hand.
I made a map.
She shoves it into my hand so hard it crinkles, and she smooths it out before pointing.
Go straight back and cross the creek, and then there's a weird-looking rock thing. Go right until the tire stack. Then turn left and go straight for a really long time, and the treehouse is there. But you can't go up the ladder because the nails are rusty, and Mrs. Douglas says that's how we get tetanus.
This is perfect, sweetheart. Thank you. I straighten up, handing the map to her father. You'll want to stay inside for a while. There are more agents and officers on the way.
Of course. I hope...
He swallows hard and pulls his daughter back into his side.
I hope you find her safe.
Cass meets us between the houses.
Hanoverian's here. He's staying with Mrs. Douglas. Where are we going?
We need larger flashlights, and we're going into the woods. She whistles at one of the uniforms, and in short order, we're running into the trees with heavy mag lights and the promise of backup as soon as it arrives. We should wait for it, but one look at my face, and Edison decides to let us go ahead. Guns drawn and aimed at the ground, we keep the flashlights low as we jog two by two. It's not the same as the woods back home, where the trees were spindly and needled and stabbed the sky. These are broader, the branches less keen to smack and cling. We don't talk, our huffing breaths filling the space. The noise from in front of the houses floats back, strange snippets of conversations without words. We splash through the creek, shallow but too wide to jump, and ignore the discomfort of squelching in our shoes as we look out for the rock pile the girl mentioned. We've crossed probably a mile before we see it, and we take a right. The tire stack comes up pretty quickly. Go straight for a really long time, she said, and given how far we've come already, I'm a little worried. We pick up the pace. Edison and I are in the lead, angled in opposite directions so we can have a shred of warning if Kara tries to sneak up on us. 2 miles later, we can hear someone screaming and another voice yelling. We're flat out running now, and we can finally see a clearing up ahead. We slow down as much as we dare, trying to be quiet, but there are old branches all around it like a noise trap.
Don't come any closer, the woman in white yells, grabbing Nichelle by the neck and cutting her off mid-scream.
Her gun sways back and forth next to Nichelle's face. Turning off the flashlight, I slide it through the loops on the back of my pants. Edison sighs, but nods, then motions for Sterling and Cass to each go around a different side. He settles into a crouch behind one of the trees so I can move past him.
Kara, I call. Kara, it's Mercedes. I know you don't want to hurt Nichelle. I'm making her safe, she cries, voice still muffled by the plain white mask. They'll hurt her. They always hurt her.
Like your father hurt you, I agree, stepping into the clearing. Her gun comes up to point at me, but I don't try to get too close. I know his new wife is having a little girl. Kara, I promise you, he is never going to get the chance to hurt that baby girl.
I'm keeping her safe, she insists.
Kara, can you take off the mask? Let me see your face, sweetheart. I want to make sure you're okay. She hesitates, but then she steps behind Nichelle, using her as a shield, so she can reach up with the hand holding the gun and push back the mask. It falls to the ground, taking the long silver blonde wig with it. Her natural hair is a slightly dirtier blonde, dark and damp with sweat, where it's pulled back into a tight braid. This young woman, with her wide cheekbones and filled-in face, doesn't look much like the broken girl in the photos in the file. She looks healthy, and it's hard to connect her cheerful presence at the CPS office with the child who cried whenever I left her hospital room. Until she looks up at me, and I recognize the fear. There you are, sweetheart. Are you and Nichelle okay? The little girl looks at me disbelievingly, tears tracking down her face.
I wish I could wink or smile or something, anything to reassure her. But I can't, not with Kara looking at me. Kara's crying, too, but she shakes her head.
I can't let them hurt her.
Then let me take her, Kara. You know I won't hurt her. The gun is abruptly aimed at me again.
You were supposed to keep Amelia safe, but you let her go to that woman. That woman murdered a little boy.
No, Kara, she didn't. Her brother attacked her when he was high. She defended herself. He wouldn't have died from the gunshot. It was too minor. The drugs he was on reacted badly with the anesthesia. He died because of the drugs, sweetheart. She didn't do anything wrong.
No! No, you're lying!
I've never lied to you, Kara. Let Nichelle come to me. I'll keep her safe.
No one can keep us safe, she says gravely. The world isn't safe, Mercedes. It never has been.
Her tidewater drawl, practically non-existent when she spoke to us in the office, is thick now in her distress. But we're here, Kara. Look at us, you and me. Our fathers hurt us so badly, but we survived. We're helping other kids. You did so good, sweetheart. You worked so hard to get these kids safe. Sarah? Sarah Carter? She's so relieved, Kara. She's safe now. And you did that.
Her stepfather was a bad man,
Kara says, the gun lowering slightly. He was. He hurt her, and you stopped him. Nichelle isn't struggling, but she watches me, wheels turning in her head. When Cass steps on a dry branch, the crack hanging in the air, Nichelle shifts her weight, bringing her foot down on a smaller branch. Oh, good girl. You brilliant, beautiful girl. Kara, I know you're protecting Nichelle, but do you remember when I told you there were rules? I'm not allowed to put my gun away if any other gun is out. Do you remember? The blonde nods slowly.
Daddy's friend. He had to put it down.
Exactly. I know you're keeping her safe, Kara, but you've got a gun. I'm not allowed to put mine away.
But
don't you want me to help you, Kara? She chose the name Carolyn, but Kara is the name carved into her bones, bleeding through the scars. Kara is the name of the frightened girl, the one who wants comforting, the one who trusted me. Cass and Sterling aren't going to be able to get a shot on her from the sides, not without risking Nichelle. She has to put down the gun.
I didn't mean to hurt Amelia,
she sobs.
I was just trying to protect her.
I know. I know you were. She just didn't understand. She was scared, Kara. And we do things, don't we, when we're scared? Put the gun down, sweetheart. Preferably before the helicopter I hear can get any closer and spook you. But she hesitates too long, and the helicopter comes over the clearing, the searchlight blinding. I squint against it with long practice. Kara screams.
You're trying to trick me,
she shrieks.
You lied to me.
Kara, I know you meant the best, but you killed people. There are consequences for that. Edison, Sterling, and Cass all step into the clearing, guns up and leveled at Kara. They stay back, trying to let me keep working. But I've lost her. She stares at me, tears bright in her eyes, her whole body trembling with emotion.
I'm helping them, Mercedes, like you helped me. Why, I thought you'd be proud of me. Why are you trying to stop me? Why?
Carolyn Tillerman,
Edison calls over the deafening thump of the copter blades.
Put down the gun. You are under arrest for the murders of Sandra and Daniel Wilkins, Melissa and Samuel Wong.
Her face twisted in fury. Kara lunges forward, half tripping over the resistant Nichelle, and fires. Edison drops to the ground with a grunt. Suddenly, there's a crack, and a black and red rose blooms in Kara's forehead. She takes a breath, tries to take a second, and tips backward to the ground as Nichelle struggles away from her. I glance to Sterling and Cass, but they're both looking at me. Dios mío. That was me. That was my shot. Sterling races forward to grab Nichelle, kicking the gun away and holding the girl so she can't see. Kara's sprawled across the ground, her eyes wide and startled, mouth open with shock. A groan behind me makes me spin. Edison.
Mercedes.
I drop down beside him. He's curled around his left leg, both hands clenched around as much of his lower thigh as he can manage. Blood seeps out, thick and dark, between his fingers. Holstering my gun, so much heavier than I remember it ever being, I yank off my blouse, buttons flying, and start wrapping it around the wound.
You know, he manages through gritted teeth, now they're really going to think we're sleeping together.
I yank the first knot tight over the bullet hole, and he growls.
How is he?
Asks Sterling, her voice shaking.
He'll need to get lifted out. The copter can't land, and he can't hike it. That's way too far to carry him.
Is that your way of calling me fat?
It's my way of saying, make one more joke, and I will leave you to Priya's tender mercy.
That asshole actually grins at me.
I was a model of restraint when she got hurt.
That doesn't mean she will be. He grimaces against a throbbing wave of pain, the muscles twitching under my hands.
Point.
A Marine in full gear rappels down from the hovering helicopter.
Anyone hurt?
He bellows. Cass grabs him by the elbow and shoves him our way. The Marine Corps, if I remember correctly, doesn't actually have medical personnel, but most units have corpsmen with some medical training. He gives a quick check under the rapidly soaking through bandage, then turns his head to speak into the radio on his shoulder. A second Marine drops down with a collapsible backboard and some rigging.
Oh, fuck no,
mutters Edison. I flick his forehead with bloody fingers. You will do it, and you will say thank you, I warn him ominously. And then, because he's my brother, and we're both scared out of our minds, I scratch along his scalp, fingers digging into his shaggy curls. I don't pull away until the Marines lift him up in a smooth, practiced move and transfer him onto the rigged-up board. They carry the board over to the dangling ropes, and with a series of knots that seem more fast than safe, to my inexperienced eye, have both themselves and Edison roped in. Winches in the copter haul them up. The last I see of Edison is his tired, somewhat mocking salute to the Marines pulling him on the board. Cass grabs my elbow with both hands and yanks me to my feet.
Nichelle,
she reminds us as the copter moves away. Right. Traumatized child who has absolutely no idea what's going on. She's wrapped around Sterling, face buried in Eliza's stomach, her shoulders shaking. Sterling rubs firmly between her shoulder blades, giving her a grounding point.
Nichelle?
She lifts her head to look at me with one eye. I crouch down beside her, trying not to touch either of them with my bloody hands.
You are so smart and so brave, I tell her,
You knew just what we were trying to do, didn't you?
Not at first,
she mumbles into Eliza's shirt. But you figured it out. It was so frightening, but you figured it out and you helped us. Thank you, Nichelle. I am sorry this happened, and I'm sorry I seemed to make it worse at first. And you know what? Your mom is at home, waiting, and she is so worried about you. She perks up. Not enough to let go of Sterling, but I can see her whole face at least.
Is she okay?
She asks in a rush.
She was bleeding, but I couldn't see how bad.
She's hurt, I admit, but she's going to be okay. Once she sees you're safe and sound, you'll both go to the hospital. Your dad is there already. I don't know how he's doing, though. He was in the ambulance before I got to the house. Sounds start carrying through the woods, yells and calls for us. Cass puts her phone back in her pocket, where she's standing guard over Kara's body.
Marco!
She yells, and there's a ripple of shocked laughter through the trees.
Stupid Fed, someone bellows. The one looking is supposed to say Marco.
I can't say Polo if you're not smart enough to say Marco first.
Nichelle giggles, even as she looks a bit shocked by it. Nichelle, we really are relieved that you're okay, I tell her, feeling a little giddy myself.
We might get a little silly. Is that okay?
She nods with a shy grin. A small herd arrives in the clearing, mostly uniforms with a couple of agents. A female officer immediately comes over to us and smiles down at the little girl.
Hi, Nichelle. My name is Officer Friendly. Do you remember me?
It takes her a moment, but then the giggle slips out again.
You spoke at my school. You said your name is really Officer Friendly.
And so it is, the woman says, pointing to her name tag. Hannah Friendly. While we were out looking for you, the hospital called your mom. Your dad is going to be just fine, and you'll get to see both of them really soon. Nichelle looks over to Kara, but a wall of police officers blocks her view of the body.
I...
It's okay, Nichelle. You can ask us anything.
I didn't do anything wrong, did I? She didn't take me 'cause I was bad?
Not a single thing, I answer firmly. She used to live there when she was a little girl. Her father was a bad man and hurt her, and when she got really upset about some things, she thought your parents were hurting you because you were in the same house. You didn't do anything wrong, and neither did your parents. Promise. She studies my face like she's memorizing it, her dark eyes lingering on the scars I got when I was only a year older than her, and finally nods.
Okay. And I can go home now?
Absolutely, says Officer Friendly, offering her hand. Nichelle takes it and allows herself to be led away from me and Sterling. Eliza helps me stand. Because my knees are a bit shaky in a way, I can't entirely blame on crouching. And even though I probably shouldn't, I find myself sidling between the officers to kneel down next to Kara, a safe distance away from the pool of blood from what used to be the back of her skull. A thin gold chain peaks above the collar of her white jumpsuit. Finding a sturdy-looking twig, I hook the chain and gently pull until a heart-shaped locket falls out.
Does anyone have gloves?
One of the agents from Kang's team kneels across from me, wearing a pair.
Need something picked up?
I gesture with the twig, setting the locket swaying.
I want to see what's in it.
He catches the pendant and opens it carefully. On one side, there's a picture of teenaged Kara and her plain white teddy bear. Red curtains in the back. A photo booth, probably. She's grinning, and her hair is a faded red gold with blonde roots, growing out from the scarlet her father had made it. On the other side, there's a newsprint cutout of my face, with a halo drawn in sparkly gold ink. My stomach churns, and I have to bite down on the urge to vomit.
"You can close it, thank you,"
I rasp.
"Is this healthy?"
Cass asks wryly. The question I asked Father Brendan rolls through my mind. How do we know when we're doing more harm than good?
"Mercedes, 9 years ago you rescued her, and you tried your damnedest to rescue her again today. What happened in between is not your fault. It's also not your responsibility."
"She got hurt in the system."
"So did you."
I look up at her at that, and she scowls down with an unimpressed glare.
"Look, so you've never told me, and I'm not asking now, but I'm not completely unobservant, you know? I know you were in foster care for years, but the only home you talk about is the last one. You think I can't read between the lines that shit happened at the other ones?"
"Only one was very bad," I admit. "The rest of the time I was moved because my family kept trying to take me back."
"Still? You, Mercedes Ramirez, you fucking martyr, are proof that the way she chose wasn't the only way to choose."
"Has anyone told you recently that you're bad at this?" She shrugs and hauls me up again.
"I can't be half as bad as Edison."
"There might be something to that."
"Come on, let's get back to Hanoverian so you can get back to Bethesda and check on Edison." I look back at Kara, resisting the pull on my elbow.
"I should..."
"Mercedes!"
Losing patience waiting for me to look at her, she grabs my chin and forces it.
"You gave her every kindness you could. Now, try to be kind to yourself. No one is going to desecrate her. They're just waiting for the medical examiner. Don't kneel beside her like penance."
"But that's exactly what it is, or what it should be. Penance. Vigil, maybe." She needed me to save her. Whether that's fair or not, whether it was possible or not, she needed that from me. And I failed her. Sterling slides her arm around my waist and joins in the tug of war, and the three of us tumble forward, catching ourselves just in time to prevent the Stafford PD from being able to mock us forever. 28. We get back to the Douglas house in time to see Nichelle and her mother ride off in an ambulance. Vic, standing in the driveway, checks us over with worried eyes before yanking all three of us into a hug. The gathered officers and agents laugh at our flailing attempts to regain balance because Vic doesn't really need to be landing on the concrete, but Vic just as clearly does not give a shit. He is not about to let us go. Cass wriggles out at first, flushed bright pink. She's been loaned to our team on occasion, but I don't think she's ever had a Hanoverian hug. Sterling and I shift to settle more comfortably into the embrace, which feels like home.
"Edison got shot in the leg," I mumble into his coat.
"I know. We'll go see him. You just have to give a statement and we can go." That would mean letting go. He keeps his arm around my shoulders, even when we all finally stand up straight, and Cass calls Watts so we can give our statements directly to her. It's pretty no-frills, especially in light of what's to come. An agent discharged a weapon, and a suspect died, so IA automatically has to conduct an investigation. The fact that my presence on the scene was borderline not allowed, requested by the agent in charge, but technically against regulations, will make it a bit more complicated. So Watts just has us march through it all together, clustered around the phone like that mystery date game we played in middle and high school.
I'll get Edison's car back to Quantico, Cass says when the call is done. You and Watts can trade back in the next couple of days, unless you need something right off.
Sterling shrugs. At this point, even if I did need something, I wouldn't know what it was, she admits.
Do you have an agent you'd trust to drive Watts's car back to the garage? Vic asks. That way they can just ride up with me.
Sure. She's let Cuomo drive it without too much grief, and he's back in the woods. I'll let him know.
Sterling hands over the keys, and we pile into Vic's car for the drive to Bethesda.
It's quiet, the CD player crooning one of his favorite Billie Holiday albums.
The blood on my hands is starting to itch, but if I scratch or rub, it's going to flake off all over Vic's car. Which, granted, has seen a lot worse from his daughters, but still. It feels a bit like penance, and Cass isn't here to yell at me for this one.
Our purses are in my car, Sterling announces suddenly.
Okay.
I drove to Stafford without my license.
I turn around to stare at her in the middle seat. She meets my eyes with a sheepish smile and shrugs.
And suddenly, I'm laughing my ass off, trying to imagine explaining to a police officer why we were going 135 without a license, and I can hear her giggling, too, and even Vic is chuckling, because he also knows how Sterling drives when she's determined to get somewhere now.
It's stupid and ridiculous, and I can't stop laughing until the laughter abruptly turns to tears, and I'm sobbing into my shoulder so I don't get blood all over my face. Christ. Sterling unbuckles her belt and slides up between the front seats as best she can, awkwardly bending over the center console to wrap me in another hug.
She's saying something, her voice soft, no louder than Billie Holiday, really, but I don't know what the words are.
It takes me entirely too long to realize that's because she is speaking Hebrew, and I wonder if it's a prayer or a lullaby or a very gentle remonstrance for me to get my head out of my ass. It's Sterling. It could be any or even all of the above. When we get to the hospital, Vic parks and pulls a handkerchief from his pocket, wiping my cheeks and throat. I try to help, but he bats my hands away, and yeah, they're covered in blood. For some reason, I keep sticking on that. Edison, we learn, is in surgery, and they're not sure yet if they need to put hardware in and around his femur. It's broken, definitely, but given that he's an active agent, the surgeon is going to do her best to avoid anything that could keep him out of the field. That's how I remember Bethesda is a military hospital. Sterling hauls me into a bathroom to wash my hands and face. When we rejoin Vic in the waiting room, he's on the phone with Priya, letting her know about Edison. I wasn't sure he'd call her so late, but then, this is Priya. Not only is Edison her brother, but she goes semi-nocturnal during summers anyway. Vic's voice is calm and soothing, the kind of voice we all automatically respond to after so many years. Even Sterling's shoulders loosen a few inches. At some point, Vic goes off to find coffee and breakfast, leaving Sterling slumped half asleep against me. I pull my credentials out of my pocket and fold them back to rest badge up on my knee. My badge is 10 years old, and it shows in a million ways. The gold is worn and dull at the highest points of the letters, where the metal rubs against the black leather divider of the credentials case. One edge has a chip from getting slammed onto a curb in a takedown, and there's a line of dried blood down the inside of the U in U.S. that no amount of cleaning can seem to get rid of. And the eagle at the top is mostly decapitated because baby Angel Cass, with her fear of guns, used to forget that guns have this thing called a safety. The day Cass murdered the eagle on my badge, which had been sitting on the Lane's ammo shelf where it should have been safe, was the same day she got the rangemaster as her personal tutor. The rangemaster said it was in the interest of everyone's well-being. Still, blind and burdened justice stays in stark relief near the center of the badge. Ideally, our task is to be justice. Without prejudice or preconceived notions, weigh the information and bring down the sword. I run a finger along the eagle's wings, tracing the letters that have shaped almost a third of my life. Federal Bureau of Investigation, Department of Justice. When I first got the badge, I used to run my finger along the words in almost the same way, tracing them over and over, like it was the only way to convince myself it was real. It was new and inspiring and terrifying, and so much changes in a decade. Some things don't. It's still terrifying. I knew better than most, going into this, that the FBI isn't, can't be, anything simple. And yet I still expected it to be easy. No, easy isn't the right word. I expected it to be straightforward. Challenging, yes, and sometimes painful, but unwavering. It never occurred to me that I might come to question the good I do. It's never been a mystery that the system is flawed. My third set of fosters included a skeevy man and his near-adult son who liked to watch the girls when they showered. I learned to skip lunch and shower at school, and the older girls followed suit. The younger ones didn't have showers or gyms, but we could move them through the bathroom at the house pretty quickly, with one or two of us standing guard while the men were gone. But I was also lucky. Most of the homes were safe, and if not all of them were warm, they provided necessities without stripping too much dignity from us in return. My last fosters, the mothers, they were different, rare, and I think I knew that even then. How many kids do we rescue who aren't that lucky? How many who don't have a safe family to go back to end up even worse than where they started? How many Karas are out there, one trigger away from snapping and killing others in the course of their spiral of self-destruction? How many have I helped create? "You're hurting my brain," mumbles Sterling. "Stop it." "Trying." "No, you're not." She reaches up, arm heavy with fatigue, and clumsily pats at my face. "It's okay. Bad day." "What do you do to get through an impossible day?" "Let you and Edison spend most of it pouring me full of booze."
"Okay, there's that."
"Vic is here," she continues after a minute, "because he has the same fears as most about those parents. Edison is here because he doesn't want any other family to have the weight and pain of always wondering. I'm here because I know how hard these crimes are on family and friends, and I want to ease that burden
where I can. Of course we're here for the kids. Of course we are. But we also have all those other reasons.